my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Let's please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Nick.
Hello, I'm Nick and I'm an alcoholic. Alrighty, so let me set my timer here. I'm really grateful to be here tonight with you guys. This used to be one of my regular meetings, and I remember I was maybe a month or two sober when I started to come to meetings here, and I would hear people get up and they'd share their story. I was like, wow, that's a big deal to be up there telling their tale in front of all these people. And I thought, oh, but you know, they've been sober 5 years, 10 years. They all have these incredible stories. And then Bill asked me to share a few weeks ago, a month ago, whatever it was. And I was like, what, me? Really? But one of the things is that everybody's story has something, some similarity, something that you think, oh yeah. And that's one thing I've learned is a lot of times I'll hear somebody share their story, very different from mine, but there's usually that, they say that thing, listen to the similarities. There's that thing that you can take away. So tonight, I hope that you hear some thing you can take away, find some similarity in what I'm about to share. So, I was born in Visalia. I was born at Kaweah Delta. My parents are from the valley. They met at Tagus Ranch, and they were high school sweethearts, actually, at Tulare Union. Tulare Western. Tulare Western. And they had my sister, and then 8 years later, they had me. And my dad was a banker, and he got a job in L.A. So when I was about 4 or 5, we moved to L.A. I went to a Catholic school there for 9 years, kindergarten through 8th. And then I came back here to Visalia for high school. And I went to Golden West, and I had a good time there for the most part. I did very well in school. I graduated at the top of my class. I gave the commencement speech. I applied and was accepted to Stanford University. So I went there after graduation. And, you know, for me, growing up in the valley, a big goal for me was to leave. So I thought if I study hard and get good grades and go to a good college, get a good job, earn lots of money, and be happy. But so when I left, and it was 1995 is when I graduated, so, and I left that year to attend Stanford, my whole life, feeling different from other people, having anxiety, not knowing necessarily how to talk to people or where I fit in, that's always been an issue for me. And in high school, I got around it sober by basically studying hard. You know, I had a few close friends, which was important to me. But when I got to college, I was in a new environment with all sorts of people I didn't know, all sorts of brilliant people that I felt really inferior. I felt out of place. I felt, you know, this anxiety, the social anxiety crept up. But now I was in an environment where, you know, there was alcohol. And I had always been a little dubious or a little wary of alcohol because alcoholism runs in my family. And I've seen what it does. I've seen how people act. I would always hate to be around some of my relatives when they were drinking. I was like, they're stupid, they're crazy. Why would anybody do that? And, well, I found out. So in my freshman year, I went to a frat party. And I tried, but up to this point, the only drinks I'd had are maybe a sip of wine or a sip of beer, which I thought was nasty. I was like, I'm never going to drink. But I had a gin and what I believe was tonic. And I hated the taste, but I loved the effect. I loved how it relieved me of that anxiety. How all of a sudden I didn't feel different from the other kids. I didn't feel like I was inside my head. I felt popular. I felt loved. I felt attractive. You know, I felt like one of the crowd. So even that night I got so drunk. The next day my RA had to take care of me. The next day I was ill. The day after that I think I could still taste the gin or smell the gin. But the takeaway from that first drunk is that alcohol does for me what, you know, I can't do for myself. It makes me fit in. And so in college, that started my drinking career. But college is very demanding. Again, I didn't want to be like some of my relatives. So I would limit my drinking, control my drinking. I limited it to the weekends. We'd buy a bottle of cheap vodka, the pop-off usually, and we would have that we'd have that Friday night. And we would drink and drink until it was gone. And it was usually, we'd start out with, you know, a group of 5 to 10. But by the time we're getting down to the very end of the bottle, it's just me and my other drinking buddy, who didn't turn out to be an alcoholic, but he is one of the people who could drink like I did. When I started to drink, I wanted to keep going. I wanted the effect. I wanted to be drunk. I wanted to be outside of my head, outside of my feelings. And so in college, I continued to drink like that the whole time. It was fun, though, because, again, it took me out of myself. I got to do things I ordinarily wouldn't do. One time we thought we heard people calling out to us on a raft in the lake, so we took a raft out there and proceeded to get drunk and lost the oar and couldn't get back. I was running for the student senate, and I promised a friend who could probably already see the alcoholism developing. I promised her, because she was my campaign manager, I'm not going to get drunk tonight. And she's like, okay, well, let's make a bet. I'm like, sure, you know, I'll make a bet, $10, $5, whatever it was. So, of course, you know, I start out the night, I'm just going to have this one drink. I'm in a campaign right now. I have a bet. There's money on the line and I can do this. I have one drink, another drink. Really, the next thing that I am aware of, or not aware of, but that I'm being shown the next day, is one of our dorm staff had the great idea to film our party that night. And on me on the tape is saying that I won my fucking bet, you know, like, sorry for the profanity. But, like, it was embarrassing. This was the start of embarrassing moments of alcohol. But I put it off that I'm a kid, I'm in college, I'm having fun, I'm doing well, you know, so I didn't think anything of it. I was like, at this point, you know, I'm going to control my drinking and not become an alcoholic, not act like the people that I've seen in my life. So I graduated from Stanford after 4 years, and I did some research for one of my professors. She studied aging and psychology. I thought I wanted to be a clinician, but I got in there, and you know, the research, the idea of 6 years of school seemed too long, and I've always liked the softer, easier way. So I decided not to pursue my PhD, and instead I interviewed for a finance job. Charles Schwab and Company, which is a big investment house, was recruiting on campus. And so I gave them my resume. I was friends with one of the recruiters. And 2 weeks later, I had my official offer letter to join a management training program for Charles Schwab. And I thought, great. You know, now the stock market was going wild. This was back in 2000. So stock market's going wild, but these dot-coms are going wild. I had friends, I went to Stanford, which is in the heart of Silicon Valley. I had friends who were being recruited, starting off at $100,000, all these stock options. They were all going to retire in 5 years. I want a piece of that. I don't want to be, stuck for the next 6 years studying. I want a piece of that. And so I thought through that I could. But as fate would have it, the dot-com bubble imploded probably 6 months. Not even 6 months. I signed the paperwork, went to Europe for a couple weeks, and while I was in Europe, all this news was coming back about the market collapse, about dot-coms. They even delayed the start of my management training class because they weren't sure they were going to have enough money, because everything is based on market value. So I thought that, it's fine, whatever. I came back, I started my training program. They told us markets go up and down, which they do, and, to ride it out. So I did this program. I started to work for Schwab. Given the economy, I started off in the front desk, which the person you walk in, they say, hello, how can I help you, take your deposit, and it was a little bit humbling for me because I went to a top university. I thought I should be a broker right away, but, God in the market had other ideas, which was fine. It was fine. It's where I needed to be. It actually probably, in that way, kept me out of being fired when the big layoff started to happen. Because they didn't care, they were paying me something $40,000, $45,000. So they're like, as the rounds of layoffs happened, I stayed on. And eventually I did become a broker. I passed all my securities license test. I became a broker, a salesperson essentially. And always being shy and anxious, the prospect of sales and financial sales at that, talking to rich, successful people about their money was daunting to me. But again, I knew, I saw what the other brokers were doing, I knew what I could do, and that was to use alcohol. We actually had an event staff, a team of people who would come and train brokers about, how to act with clients, what to say, throwing parties, stuff like that. And they called alcohol a social lubricant. And I'm like, great, that's what I need. Give me more of it. So I did very well. I did my job sober. If I drank, I would drink in the evenings at happy hours with friends, on the weekends. But what was different about my drink is that when I would drink, I was again wanting to go to that place where I felt outside of my head. I felt comfortable. I felt engaging. I felt like a great salesperson. And oftentimes, especially in the beginning, I could get around there and then I'd be home before, anything really bad happens. Toward the end of my drinking, at those same client events, again, more embarrassing stories would ensue. And I'd be, fortunately, I'll get to that later. But again, so now I'm in a place where I'm making money. I've left by Sally, I'm making money, I'm drinking like a normal person, for the most part. And the market begins to come back a little bit. I'm very good at my job. At one point, after about 5 years, at one point I was promoted to vice president and moved to our flagship office in San Francisco. I thought, this is great, I'm 20-something years old, they're starting me off with like all these incentives and things, I'll be making $100,000, good. Now I can really have some fun. Now I can do a lot of the things I've always wanted to do, spend the money I've always wanted to spend. And I started to live, a pretty good lifestyle. But still, drinking regularly. And when I drank, differently than my other friends. So as time progressed, a very formative part of my life happened. I met my first partner. And he, unbeknownst to me, when I met him, we met in a Walgreens, not at a bar or anywhere like that, but we met at a Walgreens. I thought he was really cute. I got up the courage to talk to him, you know, sober, and we quickly set a date to go for a drink. So we went for a drink, and he liked drinking like I did, and actually he liked it a little bit more. We would start to drink together. I was like, oh, he can keep up. We're having fun. It's good. He didn't have a job, but that's okay. I can pay for him. I have money. And in about a month and a half, we were making plans to move in together. I was going to leave my comfortable situation where I was paying about $800 a month in rent, which for San Francisco is very good, even at this point. It's a great, great deal, great house. I'm going to leave it so that I can go play house with him. And so that in about 2 or 3 months into this, we'd moved. I found a great apartment. You know, work's going well. About 2 or 3 months into this, like, there were times when I would stop, you know, after some time because I need to get up for work. But he would just keep drinking and keep drinking. And he was, when I look back at it now, when I met him, he was already an active alcoholic. I didn't see that. He was also an active user, which I found out later down the road. And he kept that. I was with him for a solid 5 years. It was only in the fourth year that I found out he was doing things other than alcohol. So in this relationship, so we're drinking together. My drinking really kicks up. Well, now I'm drinking every day. Now it's going from I drink to celebrate, you know, a big close at work. I drink to celebrate losing a client or to commemorate losing a client. You know, drink for anything. But we're drinking together, still have a life, still a great apartment, and there is I reached that next level of success where now I'm the top broker in the country. And so I'm making hundreds of thousands of dollars, a lot of it stock options. And I'm like, let's buy a house. Let's buy two houses. Let's buy a car, another car. You want a motorcycle? I'll buy a motorcycle. Let's do all this. And realizing that I'm trying to keep this alcoholic happy. And when he would drink, he would get mean and abusive, and I would do things to placate him. And in my own drinking, I couldn't take a step back and see, you know, this isn't right. This is going to lead to a bad place. Even though I now, at this point in my life, had friends telling me, you know, maybe there's something about Zach. Maybe you guys, you know, you could try having smoothies at night instead of wine. I'm like, no, don't worry. I got this. I'm smart. I went to Stanford. I'm successful. All these things. Don't worry. I have this. And which, you know, that was sort of the illusion that, you know, alcohol created. So at this point, this relationship becomes toxic, abusive. I'm not sure how to get out of it. You know, we're getting police calls to our house. Our downstairs neighbor hates us. He was a dick, though, but he hates us. My partner has lost his job because he would rather be at the bar. He's using my money. I'm getting resentful. It's all beginning to come down. And it's also at this point that we have, like, remember what I said, markets go up and down. The market's been up, and now it begins to come down a little bit. And not only the stock market, but the housing markets. So at this point, I just bought a house. And in San Francisco, though, there's this belief that is true, that has been true, that housing markets and housing prices increase every year despite what is happening. And that is true and has always been true, except the one time I bought a house in San Francisco. That next year, not only had I leveraged myself at the urging of my partner who I'm trying to make happy, And also, you know, in my clouded, you know, I'm making decisions after a couple bottles of wine and high on alcohol and ego. But the markets collapse, so there's no equity to go to. These stock markets are going down, so my income goes down. Zach's not working. I go from making, you know, $250,000 a year to making $100,000 a year. Sounds like a lot, and it is a lot, and I would love to have that money back. But when you have grown in a lifestyle that is at $250,000, very unwisely, suddenly it catches up to you really quick. And I ended up leaving that relationship, and messily as I could, left that relationship, but not before I had had financial wreckage. I was now drinking every day, and he had introduced and I had adopted his other bad habits. So, but I go, I get my own apartment in the Castro. I'm going to live a nice, big, gay, single life. I still have some money. I'll figure out the markets will come back, and I have a way to pay everything off. It's going to happen. Except that it didn't. Because of the financial wreckage, because of bad decisions, because I started to show up late for work, because I'd rather be out late drinking and other things, I eventually had to resign from my job. So now it's, you know, I've left Visalia, I've done well, I've had all of this, I resigned from my job, and the writing is on the wall that I need to sell the houses, the cars, you know, I need to do something. But, you know, and you would think I would have done it quicker. I would have, like, filed for bankruptcy. I would have done all these things. But it was my ego in a lot of ways and my clouded judgment when I would drink and use and say, it's going to be okay. I don't have to do anything. It's just going to be okay. I can continue to live and do what I'm doing, and it's going to be fine. Well, I resigned from my job at Schwab, and I was unemployed for a while, very low point in my life. I would look for work, but it was really just a way. I had a little bit of money saved up. I started to dip into my 401k. So, you know, it was fine. It was fine. But it wasn't. And eventually I started to really make some moves, and I found a job working for a former client. And he owned two big bars in San Francisco called Badlands and Toad Hall. Don't know if any of you have been there, but they're big bars. My first experience in a gay bar was at Badlands. And I remember walking in. I was already way drunk. I walked in, and I remember looking at the bartenders and thinking, you know, they're so attractive, and everybody likes them, and they're quick. I couldn't, you know, wow. And then here, 10, 12 years later, I'm being offered a job to be a bartender and also help manage some of his businesses and do his social media and stuff like that. I'm like, you know what? This is great. Doesn't pay nearly what I thought it would be, but it feeds my ego of, you know, doing something important, you know. It gives me some money. And more than that, it gets me into a world that I had always romanticized, this world of partying and pretty boys and, you know, lots of alcohol and drugs. It gets me into that world. And not only that, but it puts me at the top of it. Now, I am promoting. I'm looking to hire our go-go boys. I'm looking to hire our drag queens. You know, I have a lot of say of what's happening in this business. But to do that, this is the point where I can definitively say I started to drink alcoholically, and I became an addict. It was at this point where I'm drinking in any time of the day. It doesn't matter, and it's okay because I'm a bartender, and this is my job. And my life quickly gets very, very unmanageable. And I eventually, I have my own apartment that I loved, It cost me $2,000 a month. I should have been able to pay for it with what I was making at the bars, but I just couldn't, you know, ever cobble together. I was always short. Eventually, my landlord got tired of me, and he asked me in a very nice way, because we were always up to butt to leave. I'm like, shit, what do I do now? So I found a room. I conned myself into a room that was $1,450 a month. Now I'm for sure I can do this. I can do this. But no, even though I made plenty of money, the priorities in my life at this time were alcohol, drugs, pleasing other people. I still have all this financial wreckage looming over me, getting rid of the anxiety, getting rid of those thoughts of like, what have you done? You know, I'm avoiding my family, avoiding friends who by now have kind of like, you know, wiped me out of their lives. And now I've gone from having houses and cars to my own place to now I'm sharing a two-bedroom apartment that I can't even afford, or that I'm choosing not to afford. But even then, I'm like, okay, you know, I got this. It's going to be fine. You know, all I need is my alcohol, my then boyfriend who was one of my former go-go boys. That seemed like a good idea. But he was also an alcoholic and an addict. And he had tried AA, actually. And so anyway, our relationship, we had a great time. We had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fights, too, which were always, always around alcohol and drugs. But we had a lot of great, great times. But when we would fight, it was pretty bad. And one night, I had just gone off on him. I was in this alcoholic rage, and I was sure he was cheating behind me or planning to leave me or something like this. And I barely remember it, but I remember smashing his things. I remember kicking him out. And he said, you need to go to AA. Now, here's somebody who, you know, has tried AA, says it doesn't work, but I'm apparently a bad enough alcoholic and addict, and he knows a lot of them, that he's sending me to AA. He gives me his AA book, says, you either go to AA or I'm out of here. So I went to my first meeting, and I go in, and it feels really odd to me. I'm still half drunk. They're talking about all these things. They're saying things, you know, but I'm like, if I do this, he'll get off my back, or maybe I'll learn something. Maybe I'll learn how to drink better, you know, or I'll get something out. And, but, you know, slowly, he doesn't want to lose his drinking partner, I surmise, and I calmed down a little bit. So we started to drink together again, very like a few days afterwards. And I was still hitting up a few AA meetings. That was part of our deal. But this is the beginning of the end for me. When he tells me to go to AA. Shortly after this point, I lose my job at the bar. And now I definitely can't afford anything except my daily bottle of vodka and maybe some food. And even at this point, I'm still thinking, you know, maybe it's just not so bad. This is just a rough patch. But when my boss laid me off, he gave me a severance. I spent through that. It was a great Christmas, by the way. But I spent through that. And then my unemployment wasn't kicking in. I was filing. He wasn't fighting that it should have kicked in. It didn't. So we came up with this plan that I was going to go back home to Visalia. And I would come back here, I'd dry out, I would go back, I'd get a job, and it was all going to be good again. I was going to learn to party better. And we just needed a break. So I came down here, decided, okay, well, I can't be drinking anymore, so I don't know how I did it. This is, again, I'm going to And this last part here, I'm going to talk about God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Somehow, I was able to say, at this point in my life, I'm drinking in the morning. It's my first thought when I get up. It's my first thought before I go to bed. And it's my thought a couple times a night when I wake up to have a drink. And somehow, I said, okay, I'm going to put it down. I'm going to go to Visalia. And part of my deal in coming back was I'm going to go to AA. And like I mentioned earlier, I have many alcoholics in my family, many drunks. But I have an alcoholic who goes to meetings, and that's my dad. And he has contacts here. So he put me in touch with Jim D. I don't know if some of you know him. But Big Jim, smaller now, but puts me in touch with him. And Jim, doing his AA duty, would take me to meetings every day. We'd go to the Alano at noon. And I had nothing else to do, and it's part of my deal to be here, so I started to go with him. And at least now I had somebody who was explaining things to me, who I could sit by. I wouldn't feel anxious, and eventually I got into the routine of it. I started to like it. And now again, another example of God working in my life, besides making it so that I got back here. My relationship in San Francisco ended. And so now I had no reason to go back. No reason at all. No money, no job. Embarrassed to see my roommate after all I put him through. And so I decided I would move down here. So I moved down here in May of 2015. My sober date is 3/19/15. But I decided to finally make the move down here. So now I've gone from having left Visalia. I thought, okay, I've made it. I've gone to Stanford, been a very successful broker. I've all of these things, and now I'm back home. I'm back in Visalia. And it was a little bit of defeat, but I had no other place to go. Learned a lot of humility about that. And like, I'm just going to do the program. It's worked. I have no other recourse except to the next street, stop at the streets, I suppose, or death or something. So I stopped drinking knowing that I ought to stop drinking. And it slowly started to work. Like for me, I started to feel happy. I started to see it. I started to, you know, just feel physically better. I had gained in my drinking, I'd gained 40 or 50 pounds, almost 200 pounds when, you know, I really should be more about 160. And I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. But in my early sobriety, what was really key for me was just going to all the meetings I could, being willing to hear, listening for the similarities. This is not in the book, but exercise, that really started to work for me. Having a routine, having that, I was taking the suggestions of others of getting up, praying, meditating, going to a meeting, and then being of service. So it was about 3 months-ish into my sobriety when, maybe not that long, but I'd been sober for a minute, but I found out about the Rainbow Group here in Visalia. It meets at Saturdays, 5:30 over at the Queer Rehab, and it's the LGBT group. Everybody's welcome. I found out about that. I talked to Reyes, who's one of the founders of that meeting. He's like, yeah, come down. I'm like, okay, I will. I want to be with my people, I guess. I walked 2 miles to get to that meeting, that first meeting. And I'm glad I walked that day. It was hot, but I'm glad I walked that day because that really made me want to be there. And I felt like I had to do something to be there. I started to really feel like I was starting to take the action for my sobriety. So I go to the meeting. I start to meet new people. I ask Reyes to be my sponsor, and I start to work the steps. And I just always heard, work the steps, work the steps. And it was such a daunting thing. First, finding a sponsor. Two, the steps, they're like they're on the wall, but how do you work them? And I just started to listen. Because again, at this point, I know that I shouldn't drink. Drinking's gotten me here. I realize that now. Nothing was fine. It's a progressive disease, like it says in the book. I started off drinking in college to have fun, and now I'm drinking because I have to, and all the wreckage. But it was around my third step, and I remember sitting with Reyes at the Starbucks. I remember it so clearly because I remember the feeling of having a feeling like everything's going to be okay. I can do this. It's a new start. And in that moment, ever since then, I have been neutral around alcohol. I used to think about how am I ever going to get through life, but I shouldn't drink. It was right around that third step, which was in late October, that's the point where I can say it's really working for me. I don't feel compelled to drink. I can be around alcohol. I am okay. And that's nothing that I did. That is what I believe God and Spirit doing for me. So at this point, I'm at my third step, begin the fourth step. I'm getting involved. I'm getting really excited about AA because not only, and I'll wrap up here in a few minutes, not only am I feeling better, I'm looking better, but now I'm starting to get things back. I'm starting to work again as a substitute teacher. I start to meet my first real friends. I start to feel a part of, which is, again, something that I've always struggled with. And I got into service. I've been secretary of meetings. Right now, I am the GSR for a couple meetings. You know, I helped with the CSR people to set up some electronic payments for central office. Somebody mentioned earlier about saying yes to AA request. That's what I do. That's actually why I'm here tonight. Is other people said yes to me. Other people have been there for me. So now it's my turn to be grateful for my sobriety. Right now I'm on the A step. I'm doing this thing about removing character defects, and that's a challenge. It's like, that's what am I going to be like? What the person I'm going to be like? But I pray, and like magic, my thoughts have changed. Situations which could have tempted bad behavior just removed from me. Like, and again, this is sort of what I want to, this long story, what I want to really for you guys to take away is that it's God that has got to me here. I never wanted to be on this stage up here tonight. A year and a half ago, I've been, oh, hell no. But it's my thinking, my will, that got me out of Visalia and then back to Visalia, thank God. And it's, I look and I see how God is working in my life, delaying my unemployment, getting me here, ending my relationship, putting me in the contact with the right people at the right time, having that luxury to concentrate on my sobriety, meeting the right people. And then, I mean, the biggest thing of all is being neutral around alcohol now. My sobriety today, I have my first sponsee. That has been an amazing boost to my program, working with him, sort of redoing some steps, seeing him come along in the program. From, I remember his first meeting to where he's at now. He's at the young people's meeting that we helped start. It's young people's at the Center for Spiritual Living at 7 p.m. He's there. He's the literature person. I have one of my best friends in the world who I never would have met otherwise is sitting over here. I have a new relationship. I have so many things that I've gotten back. Jobs, opportunities to be of service not only to AA, but to the community through the LGBT plus center we're starting here called The Source. I'm speaking tomorrow at the Rawhide to a group of Christians about how we can partner together. I have been given a second chance to do things, and I'm really grateful for that. So every day I do the same things that I started. I pray. If I can find time, I meditate, but I pray. I talk to other alcoholics. I go to as many meetings as I can. I say yes to AA request. And it's working out really well. So with that, I just want to close with my favorite prayer is the third step prayer. What I really like about it is how it talks about getting ego out of the way, that it's God's will. And And that, even on days like recently when I have so much going on and I'm worried about the future, what's going to happen here? What's he going to do? What's she going to do? What's my life going to look like? I still have bills. What's happening? It's that God has taken care of me up till now. And I have every faith that what is ever happening now is what's supposed to be happening, and that it's God's will, not mine. And with that, I will keep coming back. I'm Nick Alcoholic.